This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Since so many of us are staying home now, looking for things to see or listen to lift our spirits or deepen our sense of connection in this period of isolation, we're going to occasionally bring out something from our archive that seems right for the moment. Today we're going to listen to the interview and performance Terry recorded with songwriter, pianist, and singer Iris Dement, whose music was deeply influenced by the Delta and the Pentecostal Church. If you don't recognize her name, maybe you know her song Let the Mystery Be, which was used as the theme song on the HBO series The Leftovers. Her version of the hymn Leaning on His Everlasting Arms was used at the end of the Coen Brothers movie True Grit. Dement was born in Arkansas on the Delta, the youngest of 14 children. Her family moved to California when she was three. They belonged to the Pentecostal Church, where they all sang. Dement is no longer affiliated with the church. She now lives in Ames, Iowa, where she tells us she's sheltering in place and sewing a lot of masks and thinking about her mother, who was born during the 1918 influenza pandemic and who taught her how to sew. When Terry spoke with her in 2015, Iris Dement was seated at a piano at an Iowa public radio studio. She started with a recording from her album, The Trackless Woods, on which Dement has set to music the poems of the late Russian writer Anna Akhmatova, who Stalin named an enemy of the state. This poem is about staying in Russia and fighting for what she believed. It's called Not With Deserters.
Not with deserters from the battle that tears my land, do I belong? To their coarse praise I do not listen. They shall not have from me one song. Poor exile, you are like a prisoner to me.
Iris Dement, welcome to Fresh Air. You've said that these poems by Anna Akhmatova spoke to you because you adopted your daughter, Dasha, from Siberia when she was six, and you wanted to connect with the culture that she's from. How old was she when you started this project?
Dasha would have been maybe about 12 years old. The poems, I first started setting them about 4 years ago, and you know, I was playing these song poems around the house while she was running around and playing, and half the time, you know, with her headphones on, listening to pop music. And I didn't try to pull her along into that. The extent to which she absorbed that is her story to tell and yet to be seen in the future.
Akhmatova was accused under Stalin of being an enemy of the state. Her son was imprisoned because he was her son. She lost friends who were executed, but she didn't want to flee. She wanted to stay and fight for her country and be with her country. And she thought that her poems could bring something of value to the people in Russia. Do you have that kind of faith in your own art?
Well, I've not had to endure the test of it to even the slightest degree that she did. But I would have to say that, yes, I do. It sounds maybe a little arrogant. I don't know. But yes, I do. I am extremely shy and never wanted to be on a stage. But the music propelled me there. When the songs started coming to me, I felt I didn't have that option, you know, to hide and avoid my most least a desirable spot in life, which is in the spotlight. So I guess that would answer your question, kind of, wouldn't it? Yes, I do.
As we've talked about, place is so important to you in this project for Anna Akhmatova, but also in your own songs. A couple of years ago, you released an album called Sing the Delta, And the music is very inspired by the Delta, where you were born and were raised till the age of three, and then your family moved to California. You were born in Arkansas. Tell us a little bit about the music you were first exposed to.
Well, the music, I have a very large family. I was actually the last of 14 children. And when I was very young, my parents sold a farm and moved into town, and my dad took a factory job. And the way we wound up in California is my dad had staged a wildcat strike at the Emerson Electric plant with some other guys. And after a year of standing on the picket line, they didn't get the union. So literally, as a last-minute thing, my dad packed up and hitched a ride out to California, and then later my brother moved my mom and the last 10 kids out to California in the station wagon. But the music that I heard, my mom sang pretty much nonstop. Anything she was doing, she was singing. And often we call it banging on the piano, because the only times I remember my mom playing the piano was when things had just gotten pretty tense and awful and she didn't feel like she could bear it anymore. She would go over and she'd take her singing over to the piano and kind of beat out her frustrations, which was quite a thing to witness as a child, I must say. But so I heard that Southern gospel sound. You know, the first non-religious singing, you know, secular, I guess they call it, singing that I heard was these country singers who would put out a country record. You know, that's how I was first introduced to Johnny Cash, and that's how I got to hear, you know, Loretta Lynn and different ones. So what I heard was gospel church music, and it was by real people, you know, people that I knew and whose lives overlapped with mine until I was about 5 years old. So
since you are seated at a piano at a studio at Iowa Public Radio, can I ask you to sing a song that you heard in church when you were young that stayed with you and that inspired you musically?
Yeah, there's a long list of them, and I actually, a few years back, put out a record called Lifeline that is made up of all those songs that pretty much shaped me and that I lean on still. So, which one? I'll do Pass Me Not. We'll call it Pass Me. There are two other really beautiful verses, but we'll save that for another day.
That was beautiful. You know,
it's a pretty song.
Yeah, and you performed it so well. My guest is Iris DeMent, and she's at the piano. And she has a new album called The Trackless Woods. So it must have been so great to think of music as something that was really holy, of something that like connected you to the Holy Spirit. It wasn't just like pop tunes coming over the radio. Not that those aren't great. Not that that doesn't have a whole lot of meaning.
Yeah, the side of it that I came from is exactly what you're talking about. I think I had developed this notion that there was something silly about the Holy Spirit idea, if you want to call it an idea, and my deep link that I had in my mind and in my work to all that. It seemed like something that I was supposed to grow out of. I started to sort of separate myself a little bit from some of those ideas. And I started having terrible things happen, like I couldn't remember my words, songs I'd sang my whole life. I just became paralyzed. And it took a while. It took about a year for me to realize what I had done. And, pretty much when I returned to that place where I started, which is what you brought up in the beginning, that it's the spirit that moves through us, I began to be able to do what I needed to do again with a calm. And so I learned a great lesson there. I learned to believe in it and hold on to it, whether I can explain it or not, and whether anybody else can or not. Because I just happen to be one of those people, I'm going to go under if I don't. And, you know, on that same note, I think another thing that I learned from my parents, who had, you know, pretty difficult, challenging lives, to put it mildly, I saw my parents use music to survive, you know. They had to have that music. My mom had to sing, and my dad had to go to church, and he had to hear that music washing over him and through him. It wasn't a, oh, this is nice. It was a, I'm not going to make it if I don't have that. And so I have felt that that's my job. That's how I think of what I do. I have to give people that lifeline, you know, that I saw my parents reach out for and that I was taught to reach out for. And so that's what I aim to do. And I guess I don't feel like I can do that without that connection to the spirit.
There was a period of 16 years that elapsed between your albums of original songs. And it was in 2012 or 2013 that you released your album Sing the Delta. So you were just talking about this period where you felt like you weren't connecting with that spirit. Does that explain the absence of an album of original songs from you during that period?
You know, I think that would be safe to say some of it. A lot of happened during that time. As far as musically, I continued to go out and play, and much to my amazement, I still had people that would come and listen and get something out of it, and I would too. And I made that gospel record during that time, which was actually the only record of mine I can listen to be honest. That record means a lot to me. And there was a lot going on. I think I had a struggle for fears with some pretty severe, you know, down in the dumps kind of stuff that I was battling. And just kind of trying to figure out where I needed to go next. And then, of course, in the middle of that, we also adopted our daughter, who had been orphaned till she was six. And she came with a lot of needs, a lot of attention. And there was a lot that I had to learn about myself in order to do that job, too. So I had my hands pretty full. But I feel, just on a personal level, I can see, looking back, how much I needed that nothingness. I learned a lot, and I feel like I grew a lot in myself, just as a person, and I can bring all that to the music now. I don't know. I just accepted that it went along as that was supposed to go, and I didn't do anything wrong. You know, for a long time, I felt like I was doing something wrong because the songs weren't coming. But I'm over that now, and, you know, things have their natural timing and rhythm, and I'm a part of that natural timing and rhythm, and it was as it was supposed to be.
On your album Sing the Delta, the album that was your first album of original songs in 16 years, you have a song called Go On Ahead and Go Home, and it's home in the sense of death, not in the sense of, you know, it's about crossing over. It's not in the sense of, like, going back to your house. Is there something specific that inspired this song?
Well, one of my older brothers passed away, and that very much led to that song. And it was my my send-off to him, my attempt to honor his life.
It's a beautiful song. Would you play that song, Go On Ahead and Go Home, for us? Like an excerpt of that song that you wrote for your brother?
I would love to.
Thank you. Your parents were Pentecostals, and you grew up in the Pentecostal church. What were some of the things you witnessed when people would feel, like, overcome by the Spirit?
Well, you would see people dance. They called dancing in the Spirit. They called it being slain in the Spirit. You would fall over. People would talk in tongues. I can remember sitting on the pew one Sunday night, and we were in church a lot, at least three times a week. But I can remember a young fellow going into a trance-like state and leaping, like, over the backs of the pews and going over my head a time or two. That was one of the more extreme expressions. So.
Was it the kind of church where everybody sang as opposed to there being a separate group of singers?
We had both. I mean, there was the congregational singing. We had a choir. And then there would be different groups, you know, and my sisters had a group, the Big Dement Sisters, and when I was five, you know, there was the Little Dement Sisters were formed, and, you know, I messed up the first performance, which I don't think I ever quite got over. But one thing that I remember, even as a child, is music. I was talking earlier about my discomfort with performing. I didn't like that side of it. Even at a very young age, I felt the music really deeply, and I felt very grown up in the music. I didn't have a sense of myself as being a little kid. I felt this big stuff going on in me. I remember that first performance. I forgot my words, and I remember the audience beginning to laugh, but they weren't laughing. They were laughing in that way that I realized they thought I was cute. And it really troubled me because it wasn't that I was embarrassed so much that I forgot my words. I probably would have just got right on with it there, you know. But it was that awareness that, oh, this is a performance. I don't know, having a minimizing opinion of me it felt really weird. I didn't like that. And I really shied away from performance after that for a long time. I would, you know, I would sing in church and I'd take a solo now and again. But I found myself waiting till everyone would leave the home so I could really sing, you know. And there's like 10 kids in the house, so I'd had to wait around a long time to get a little quiet. But it was always very private, and I always felt very protective of it. I didn't want to be a show to somebody.
Your mother sang at church, right?
She sang at church. She sang in the audience, and she sometimes did solos. My mom had that same thing I have. It was always very hard for her to get up and sing. She'd get very nervous and rattled. But yes, she did. And her and my dad, they'd have knockdown dragouts every time they'd do a duet together. Because my dad had a very different approach to the music. You know, he knew how to read, and he had the timing, and he was a beautiful singer, too, and musician. My mom was very instinctual, and she'd go off on her own beat and everything, which was beautiful, But she wasn't a group singer. She wasn't a group anything, to tell you the truth. But so it was funny to watch them try to pull that off, and somehow they managed a long life together.
You recorded a duet with your mother that's on your first album, Infamous Angel. And I'd like to play that duet. It's of the song Higher Ground. Do you want to introduce this recording for us?
Oh, it's funny that you moved into that, because I just remembered I was talking in that what I was saying about my mom, how she just had to do things her own way. I brought her in. That was my first record, and that was her first time to go to Nashville. And it had been my mom's dream to go off and be a singer in Nashville at the Grand Ole Opry way back in the day. And keep in mind, my mom was born in 1918, so we're going way back there. And she never made it, married my dad, and had a bunch of kids instead. But when I did my first record, I brought her to Nashville, and we got in the studio, and I wanted her to sing that song with me, and the original plan was that she would harmonize with me, which was, I don't know, it just, the producer, everybody thought, well, that's how this should go, it's my record. So we get in there, and we did that a bunch of times, and oh, it was just awful, it was awful, it just wouldn't work, mom couldn't get with it, and we decided to just give up on it. We didn't say that, but we stopped, and we were starting to leave the room, all the players were leaving. And my mom grabbed the lyrics. She said, let's get on in there. And she told the piano player what key to play it in. And she did the song. And we just followed her. And at the end, I don't know if you can hear it, but at the end she says, now that was my key. So, and it was great. I was so happy, you know. And I'm her kid. She's gone now. But it felt so right to be in there and have mom being mom and me being the kid. I loved it, and she sang beautifully. But there again, it's that thing. She just had her own deal all the way around, and it wasn't a hateful thing. It was like, if I'm going to be here, I got to be the thing I am, and the timing and everything. I've got to do it my way. It's a beautiful thing to witness, and that's what she did.
So let's hear the duet with my guest, Iris DeMent, and her mother, recorded in... This is from a 1992 album, which would have made your mother around 74 at the time?
Probably, yeah, that sounds about right.
Okay, here we go.
I want to scream.
So that's Iris DeMent duetting with her mother on Iris DeMent's 1992 album, Infamous Angel. So did her voice influence your voice?
Oh, God, yes. In fact, I won't do it, but I can mimic my mother's voice almost to the T, and I've been doing that since I was a kid. But, so much of that was that my mom, I was aware that the thing she loved and really, really wanted in life didn't happen. And she didn't see, the avenue to get to the place she wanted to go.
Which was singing, singing professionally?
Yeah, she wanted to be a professional singer. And then my dad showed up at church one day with six kids. His wife had died, and they knew each other. They knew each other when they were kids. And she knew she was supposed to marry him and help him raise those kids. And then, of course, she went on and had eight more. So her hands were more than full.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, well, there's no doubt about it. I mean, there was this merging of my great love for music that went way back to the time I was a child and my desire to bring her out into the place in the world that she had wanted to go to. So I always felt like every step of the way in my musical life, my mom was walking with me. I was bringing her along with me, and that's how I wanted it. I don't have any regrets about that.
We've been talking a lot about church and the music you grew up with from the church and in the church. And, you know, so much of your music seems connected to that music, that church music that you grew up with. And this is an interesting twist on that, your song, Let the Mystery Be. And that is now the theme song of the second season of the HBO series, The Leftovers. And that series is about people who have just inexplicably vanished off the face of the earth. And some people think it might be the rapture or some other godly or mystical or just mysterious, superstitious thing that happened. No one really knows. But you didn't write this for the series. This is from years ago. And it sounds to me like a song from by somebody who is now secular and saying, I don't know about the answer. I'm not sure if there's a God, but I'm content to live with the mystery.
Yeah, I wrote that about 25 years ago. And yes, that is true. But I think, you know, nowadays, the thing for where I am now, maybe the way I would describe it is I don't know about God and all that stuff, and I'm not, you know, connected to a particular religion, but I like to think of it as my preacher friend Sam Mann talks about it. It's the what always was, what is, and always will be. You know, you can maybe sum that up and call it God if you want to. I don't know. But I feel that, and I tie my music up with that.
Would you sing some of Let the Mystery Be for us?
Okay.
Everybody's wondering what and where they all came from. And everybody's worried about where they will go when the whole thing's done. No.
That's a great song. That's Iris DeMent singing her song, Let the Mystery Be, which is now being used as the theme song on HBO's season 2 of The Leftovers. So is there a story behind your song, Let the Mystery Be?
Not really. Isn't that disappointing? I mean, you know, we talked a lot about my religious upbringing and, well, we didn't get a whole lot into how I kind of ventured away from that. When I was 16, I quit going to church. Because, you know, when I was a little kid, we would, you know, like I can remember standing on the street. I was like the kid on the church, on the sidewalk with my tambourine trying to get other little kids saved. That was, you know, I was that little girl.
Were you doing that on your own or were you asked to do that?
Well, it was groups. I mean, we would often do that before Sunday night service, go out into the neighborhood. The preacher would preach a little sermon. And, you know, a group of us, you know, might be my mom and different people in the church and a couple little kids. I would be one of them. And we would sing, you know, and try to get the kids in. I remember one day standing on the street and seeing these kids on their bicycle who looked like me and realizing, wow, an hour ago I was in front of my house riding my bike and I looked just like you. And now you're across the street and this thing, this religious belief has kicked in that's made me feel like you and I are a universe apart. And I didn't like that. That bothered me. Even when I was a kid, something felt a little ajar there. So, but for a long time when I was growing up, I, I decided, okay, you know, if this story's true, that everybody that doesn't think and act and carry on like we do is going to the fiery furnace. By the way, my parents didn't say that to me, but the church did. So I went with that story wholeheartedly, you know, and I made it my job to try to get my school friends saved. I thought, well, could there be a other priority? I mean, if, you know, if my friends are going to burn the fiery furnace, how can I be thinking of anything else? I can't eat my lunch. So I took that really seriously. And I remember one day asking somebody at the church, well, I need some New Testaments to give to all the kids at school. You know, that'll help them stay out of the fiery furnace. And I remember the person I asked kind of smiled at me, that thing I was talking about earlier, like, oh, cute little kid. And I realized, you don't believe this stuff, you know? And so there was a lot of little things like that along the way that started heading me in to another direction. And by the time I was 16, I didn't believe that story, you know, that there was all this separation between me and all these other people in the world just because they didn't claim Jesus Christ as their personal savior. I didn't buy it. And I have to say, it wasn't my choice to not buy it because it meant having to leave the church. And I loved going to church. I loved the music. I loved, you know, the community and the family. So it was actually a very sad day for me to have to own up to that in myself and know that if I was going to live with any personal integrity, I had to leave. So that's what I did. And music to me was tangled up in the church. I didn't know what to do with myself. So, I mean, that's probably why I didn't start writing till I was 25. And
that's really old to start writing. I mean, most people who write songs start writing in their teens.
I know, and I'm not kidding you, too. When I say start writing, I mean I didn't write two lines till I was 25.
So what happened? And what happened when you were 25 that got you writing?
Well, I dropped out of high school, and I went back to school when I was 23. I'd followed a boyfriend of mine back to Topeka, Kansas. I got my nerve up to apply to a college in the Washburn University, which was very intimidating, you know, because I hadn't been in school since 10th grade. I didn't have any confidence in myself on that level. But I got in, and I had this wonderful English 101, I guess it was, the beginning level of English. And my dream from the time I was a kid, I really wanted to write stories. And I was in that class, and she would give us these assignments to write short stories. Well, my grammar was a mess, my spelling was bad, but she would write these beautiful notes every time I'd turn in a story. And God, I hadn't thought about it in my time, I get a little choked up. She was so kind to me and so just little simple teacher notes, you know, but her red pen, you know, she'd say these really kind things. And, you know, you have an imagination, you got the, and it encouraged me. She didn't criticize what I didn't know how to do. And so I just sunk myself into that class. So at the end of that semester, I signed up for the next semester. And something had happened, and I suddenly couldn't focus on school because all I wanted to do was write songs.
Would you play that first song that you wrote, Our Town? Maybe just play a verse of it?
Yep.
And do you want to introduce it for us? Tell us what you were thinking when you wrote it.
Well, I remember that when I wrote this song, I hitched a ride. I didn't have a car at that time. I was living in Topeka, and I hitched a ride with somebody I worked with. He was going down to Oklahoma, and my brother that I talked about earlier was living in Oklahoma at that time. And I remember passing through this little town that was, you know, your typical dead town there in the Midwest. There, a lot of boarded up windows, little white buildings with peeling paint, and all the life had gone right on out of it. And that was the first time in my life that I felt a song coming on, like it wasn't just me trying to make something happen. It felt very different, and I just started seeing all these visions of the life that had gone on there. And so when I got down to my brother's house, and I remember asking him if I could borrow his guitar, and I promised I'd bring it back on my next visit, and he was nice enough to let me. And when I got home from that trip, might have been a day or two later, I remember sitting down on the floor. And I had all those images, you know, in my mind, I guess my brain had been working on the trip. And next thing you know, this song came out, and it came out just exactly how it is now. It's one of those rare ones for me that I didn't have to fool around with or change. It was just there. And it was my first song.
Would you play a bit of that song for us?
Yep.
And you know the sun's setting fast, just like they say, nothing good ever lasts. Go on now, kiss it goodbye, but hold on to your lover, 'cause your heart's bound to die. Go on now, say goodbye to our town, to our town. Can't you see the sun setting down on our town, on our town? Good night. Up the street beside the red neon light is where I met my baby on a hot summer's night. He was the tender and I ordered a beer. It's been 40 years and I'm still sitting here. But I could see the sun setting fast, just like they say, nothing good ever lasts. Go on now and kiss it goodbye, but hold on to your lover, 'cause your heart's bound to die. Go on. Our town. I could see the sun has gone down on our town, on our town. Good night.
Thank you. That's Iris DeMent playing for us, and that's the first song that she wrote, Our Town. When you realized you could write songs, did you think, like, where is that coming from?
Well, no, I didn't, because, you know, I probably sound a little like a broken record. Just talking to you, it's almost surprising me a little bit, be reminded of how much my present life and my working life was so tangled up in that church spiritual experience from so long ago. But I had always been taught, you know, growing up, that you're supposed to get a calling. They would call it that in church, you know, pray for your calling, pray for your calling. And a faith healer, we believe, you know, had a lot of faith healers in our church, but this woman came through once and she was a faith healer, and I'd never seen a woman preacher or a, you know, woman faith healer. And she was very, you know, I'm not sure now that I'm adult what all she was up to, but as a kid, watching her move and what she was doing, I was really impressed, and I really remember thinking that was what I wanted to be. I wanted to grow up, and I wanted to do that. I saw her, and I began to pray that God would give me the gift of healing. I wanted to be a healer. And I prayed and prayed and prayed and prayed, and I was quite a serious prayer. And it never happened. And here I was, you know, I'm leaving the church, and I still hadn't gotten my calling. So I was pretty disillusioned, you know, into my mid-20s, whatever. There was a deep part of me that was very saddened, you know, and let down, because I'd believed that that would happen, and it never did. And when that song came to me, it was as if somebody else walked in the room, and I can still remember, like, it wasn't like an auditory thing, but it was like a message. I heard, there you have it, Iris. And I knew what that meant. I knew that meant, that's your calling. That's what you're going to do. And I knew it. I knew it. I knew it. I knew it. There was no ounce of doubt. And even all those years I wasn't writing, there wasn't an ounce of doubt of that. I can't even explain that to you. But I knew that that was that thing I had been waiting for.
So I'd love it if you'd close with a song, if you'd play us a song. And how about a song from your latest album, The Trackless Woods, which features poems by the Russian writer Anna and I'm not sure whether it's Akhmatova or Akhmatova. You say you've heard it both ways, so I've just said it both ways, so hopefully we're covered.
That's a good plan.
And for people just tuning in, she was a Russian writer who was declared an enemy of the state by Stalin and suffered a lot as a result of being a dissident, but she wanted to stay and do her songs. And the song that I'd like you to do to close is called The Last Toast. Would you say a few words about this poem before you sing it for us?
Well, I love all these poems on this record. I can't even hardly quite get over it still that they've just come to mean so much to me. I guess you could call it, she might have been meaning the song a little more humor maybe than how I delivered it. But I don't know that I have. I think this song pretty much speaks for itself. So maybe I'll just jump right into this one.
Drink to the house already destroyed, and my whole life too awful to tell. To the loneliness we together enjoyed, I drink to you as well. With lies to the world for being so cruel and rude, and God who didn't save us or try.
Iris DeMint, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our interview with Iris DeMint was recorded in 2015 after her album, The Trackless Woods, was released. Our thanks to Iowa Public Radio, where this interview was recorded. Since our interview, Iris DeMint tells us she's continued to work on writing new songs for an album she hopes to record in the future. And these days, she's doing what everyone else is, sheltering in place and making a lot of masks while doing it. She also wrote this about her friend John Prine. Like so many of you, I'm deeply saddened by the passing of John Prine. It is my prayer that all the love he gave to this world will be returned tenfold to his family, the ones he cherished the most, and that love will help sustain them through their grief.